time when day is done.
Hi, this is Davy Jones, and you're listening to one of the coolest mixes of music I've ever heard. Anything Goes with Lise Avery.
And it's 10:18, let's call it 10:19 in the morning on this 8th day of Monday, Columbus Day, here in New York City. A pretty nice one, but maybe a couple of showers. And you're tuned into Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. I'm Lise Avery, and the gentleman we just heard singing is Steve Goodman. And he wrote that song. Yes, he did. And, well, there's a very famous kind of underground story about how Arlo Guthrie happened to get that song from Steve Goodman and had a hit with it and all that kind of things. But you guys, if you've been listening to the program for a while, you know that Steve Goodman is somebody that I have been a fan of for many, many years. Kind of a fellow that never, in my opinion, got the chance to get the fame that he deserved. He's a songwriter's songwriter, sort of kind of a folky, if you want to categorize musicians, which I never want to. But we have on the line, and I'm about to introduce, a man who wrote the biography of Steve Goodman. And the thing that blows my mind is that because this isn't exactly, Steve Goodman was not exactly one of the Rolling Stones or a Beatle, the fact that Clay Eales put the work into creating this biography, which is 800 pages, you guys, 800 pages, and yes, I'm going to be giving you a chance to win one, which is, you know, don't use it as a doorstop, because the what's inside it is pure gold. And you wonder, what would life be like with death hanging over your head? What would it be like? Most of us would push the prospect aside until the end of our days, but not Steve Goodman. He was diagnosed with a fatal disease at age 20 and managed to survive and thrive to write an anthem like City of New Orleans and so many brilliant songs. And he was an incredibly joyful, wondrous entertainer. And, well, this book, this Clay Eales biography, features interviews with folks like Arlo Guthrie, John Prine, whose birthday is this month as well, Steve Martin, Jimmy Buffett, Kris Kristofferson, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, Willie Nelson, Randy Newman, Emmylou Harris, Paul Anka. Yes, Paul Anka, that's a great story, and I'm going to ask Clay to tell you about it. Judy Collins, Tom Paxton, Pete Seeger, John Sebastian, Leo Kottke, Gordon Lightfoot, and Hillary's high school classmate, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And there's a whole lot more. You can get more information about this book by going to Clay's website, which is clayeales.com. And Eales, by the way, is spelled E-A-L-S, not like the fish. Clay, E-A-L-S.com. The name of this book, which is Steve Goodman Facing the Music, is in its third printing. Actually, when I came across it, it was the second printing, which sold out. The first printing sold out in 8 months, and the second printing sold out in 2011, and I was casting about for it, and I could not find it. It was like $200 on Amazon.com. And anyway, I figured, hey, you know what? I can reach out to Clay Eales, and that's what I did. And, well, we've been corresponding ever since, and I'm glad that I had the ability to send an email to somebody like Clay Eales and welcome him to Anything Goes this morning. Good morning, Clay.
Good morning, Lise.
From very early in the morning, guys. So you have to say thank you to Clay. Special thank you to Clay Eales for waking up across the country and having coffee at heaven knows what hour.
It's fine.
I appreciate. Do you have the day off today, Clay? Is it just to make matters worse?
Oh no! I'll be scooting into work after this.
Okay. Good to know. Well, you know, the first thing I really need to ask you, Clay, is I know as a singer what it is about Steve's work that has made me a little bit obsessed. And I want you to know that I've had a number of calls this morning from folks I haven't heard from before saying, oh my God, Steve Goodman? And it happens when I play him. It's like people come out of the woodwork.
That's
so
true.
And tell me how did you begin this project? Certainly wasn't a profit driven motive.
No. If it were about money, I couldn't even have started it. The long and the short is that I just felt that the guy deserved a book. Back in the 70s, sounds like the Paleolithic. I had all of his records. Got to see him on an early version of Soundstage, a national public TV show mm-hmm. with Arlo Guthrie.
Most of us are old enough to remember that.
Yeah. And 1977 and 1981, I got to see him in concert. The first time he was opening for Randy Newman, you know, who was touring on his hit Short People, and he had the ultimate short person opening for him. Goodman said he had to get a pair of stilts for the gig, and because he was only 5'2". You know?
Yeah, he was. He was tiny. He's shorter than Randy Newman, right? Randy
That's
Newman's 5'4".
Right.
Oh my Lord!
But
okay.
The contrast between the two. I mean, all it took was to see Steve Goodman once, and he would have you. I mean, and that particular show. I mean, to watch Randy Newman is to see maybe the top of his head over a grand piano, whereas Steve Goodman is literally dancing up there. He's the epitome of energy, and as you say, a joyous entertainer. Even his social commentary is suffused with really gentle humor, and he was just the thing is, once you saw him, he would ruin you for any other performer. and you're right. There are Goodman people all over the country. You know, there are millions of them. You just have to find them. And he made a really deep impression on a lot of people. And I just figured, as you alluded to, you know, why write the 50th book on Elvis? You know, I wooed my wife with his songs. I sent her cassette tapes. I just had his songs in my head a lot. And I was I'm a Seattle guy. And back in '84, Goodman died here in Seattle.
I didn't know that.
And after a last-ditch bone marrow transplant at Fred Hutchinson and the University of Washington, and I wrote his obituary then, and I think that's where the seed was planted to do a book on him. And long about the late '90s, it really took root, and it took a total of 8 years to research and write this thing, and it's become the project of my life. I've done a lot of other stuff, but I can't tell you the emails and the phone calls I get from people about how much it has meant to them, because Goodman meant so much to them.
And this and the history, when I first picked up this book, I thought 800 pages. This guy's completely insane, but it's great stuff.
Well, thank you. I figured that this was probably the only chance that there would be a book about Steve. And so, I'm a journalist from way back, and I figured, I wanted to do it right if it was going to be the only one, and to me, to do it right would be to be comprehensive. And part of it has to do with just the nature of Goodman himself. He touched so many people in his 36 years. I would get to the end of an interview, and unfailingly, people would say at the end, "Well, you can't just talk to me. You got to go talk to X, Y, and Z." And I just chased down those leads. I ended up interviewing more than 1,100 people for the book. And sure, a lot of famous people, but a lot of people who knew him in grade school, high school, college, just people who he had fleeting encounters with, The best kind of history is really biography, because you see it through the eyes of one person, and so there's a lot of context in this book of his life and times, and he just was. I mean, if you looked up the word gregarious in the dictionary, you'd find Steve Goodman.
Oh man! Now, did you get a chance to meet him, Clay?
This is the funny part. Yes, the second time I saw him was in a small. Small concert hall in Eugene, Oregon, and the woman I went to the show with insists that we went around backstage and met him and shook his hand, and it took about 5 or 10 seconds, but I can't remember it. I remember the show so well, but I don't remember meeting him.
That's really sad.
Well, and then all these years working on the book, I would have this recurring dream of almost being able to interview him. You know, there was this picture in my mind, or where I'm in a hotel lobby and sitting at a table, and he's coming down the stairs, and we're about to have the interview, and he walks by and he says, "Just a minute, I'll be right back." And he goes downstairs, and it's like this cloud that evaporates.
Wow. So,
but
wow.
You know, I feel very fortunate to have seen him live a couple of times, and even those who have not seen Steve Goodman, and the best Goodman was live Goodman, no question, much better than the studio recordings. They have an opportunity to see, to get a kind of a glimpse, you know, an idea of what it was like because of the videos that are up on the internet, and there also is an official DVD that combines his two Austin City Limits appearances, and so it's something that other people can enjoy as well.
I have to confess, I did not get a chance to see Steve Goodman live. I tried, but the concert, it was actually Steve, Harry Chapin, Pete Seeger, and Steve didn't make it because of his illness. And,
well, that's a very pivotal thing. That was a festival. Through his adult life, I mean, as you said, he was diagnosed at 20, and he had kept his leukemia secret, and maybe several hundred people knew it. It was kind of a joint informal agreement that they not out him on that. But in the summer of 82, when he was to play a concert with with Pete Seeger in New York City, in honor of Harry Chapin, his leukemia relapsed, and he had to go back to Sloan Kettering, and he wasn't able to make the show, and John Prine filled in. And then it was shortly after that that it became public that he had leukemia, and then for the last 2 years of his life, it was public, so to speak, and he did a lot of interviews on that topic.
Well, you know, there's so much that I don't know. I could stay talking to you all day. Not that I'm done, but I sort of came in to the Steve Goodman fanhood a little bit later on and I missed the opportunity to see him live, and you know, just I think partly because of age and college and all that kind of stuff, I wasn't hip to him until a little bit too late. But so he was diagnosed with leukemia at 20, and he actually did most of his career without people knowing that he had leukemia.
This is true. And I mean, back in the day, I mean, it's not like today where people have their own websites and sell their own albums. You had to be on a major record label.
Right.
And what that meant was, I mean, even his label didn't know, because if they... You know, at the time, we're talking 1969, 1970, and leukemia was a death sentence. I mean, he wasn't supposed to last more than a year. And he managed to last another 15 through some experimental treatment at Sloan Kettering, but he was a distinct minority of people who survived. And so imagine if you're a record company, are you going to sign somebody whom you want to have a long-term contract with and... but know that he may not be around in a year. It was just not financially the kind of thing that a record company would do. And so the record company didn't know until after they signed him.
Yeah, it was. That was quite a struggle for him. I understand that it really. And you know what I'd like to do, Clay, as long as you can hang around, since it's so terribly early there. In Seattle, do you mind if we play some of Steve's songs, and then, you know, because the leukemia has brought me in mind of Song for David, and if you could set that up, and then we'll talk about the story about that being written in that, and it's actually a funny story, sort of, that hotel room story, but the song is not funny at all. So go ahead, Clay.
Well, Song for David is his brother, and that was a ruse, a cover. The song is not about his brother David, it's about himself. It's about leukemia, and it's really the first serious song that Steve ever wrote. And it's very uncharacteristic of him. It's very serious, and it's very metaphorical, but it is a key song in the Goodman songbook because it is his first real song, and he didn't really want to put it out there as you know, some kind of a debut thing. So once he got his record contract, it's sort of hidden in the middle of his second album, and it's very much, I mean, throughout several of his songs, he uses the sun as a metaphor, a fearsome metaphor, and you'll hear in the lyrics it's not being able to win his race with the sun, and it makes it a very affecting song. He could, and the thing to remember, he could go from laugh out loud funny to very romantic to social commentary, and this one is the epitome of poignant
and emotional truth, I think.
Yes.
Also, and guys, listen to the very first lyric, which is "Weary, the weary is only a case of being unwound at the wrong time and place." You're tuned into Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. I'm Lise Avery, speaking with Steve Goodman biographer Clay Eales. You can get more information about his book about Steve Goodman, Facing the Music, at his website, clayeales.com.
Weary, though weary, is only a case of being unwound at the wrong time and place. David put down his head and he covered his face. He asked himself why he had bothered to race with the sun. Standing still would have been a mistake. He knew all along the risks he would take. Can't help thinking that the whole thing's fake. The race was fixed long before it had even been run. Sun sets a treacherous pace that only madmen try to erase. You can race it, you can chase it one moment, but then you let go. Too hot to hold, for too long I've been told. Besides, that old sun is just lucky and so weary, though weary is only a case of being unwound at the wrong time and place. David put down his head and he covered his face. He asked himself why he had bothered to race with the sun.
Mr. Steve Goodman and Song for David here on Anything Goes, and we're speaking with Steve Goodman biographer, Mr. Clay Eales. And Steve, Clay,
yes.
that song was written in a hotel room, am I correct about that?
Well, he'd written it, he'd done a fledgling version, and then when he was at Sloan Kettering Cancer Research Center, Chicago musician Ray Frank was in town to meet him And the two of them, Ray helped him with some of the cording for it, and it really came together at Sloan Kettering, you know, which is, it fits the lyric, that's for sure.
Wow. Okay. Now, why do I think that that was written in a hotel room? I thought that that was
well,
where
you sat down.
Well, maybe
you're thinking of the Paul Anka story.
Well, I am thinking of the Paul Anka story. So now I teased everybody and said, what does Paul Anka have to do with a folkie like Steve Goodman? And
right.
Which is actually quite interesting. So tell everybody, Clay Eales. What is it? Paul Anka.
Well, you wouldn't think Paul Anka and a guy like Goodman would be connected in any way. But Paul Anka was a prolific songwriter, probably a half a generation ahead of Steve Goodman. And he happened to be flying into Chicago in the spring of 71 to play the Palmer House, very ritzy place in Chicago, with his sort of Vegas-style show. And on the same plane was Kris Kristofferson. And they talked on the plane, and Paul Anka had incorporated into his act one of Kristofferson's songs. Kristofferson had just hit really big in the past year then, and Anka was singing Help Me Make It Through the Night.
Okay.
And Kristofferson was flying in to play a week at the Quiet Night in Chicago, and Anka said, can I come by and see you one of those nights? And Chris said, sure. Well, opening for Kristofferson was Steve Goodman. And so the second to the last night of the week-long gig, here comes late at night Paul Anka in his tuxedo bounding up the steps of the Quiet Night, and he actually does a guest appearance singing Help Me Make It Through the Night with Kristofferson. And this whole troupe of people, imagine in one room, not only Kristofferson and Anka and Goodman, but Samantha Eggar, who was going with Kris Kristofferson at the time,
uh-huh.
and Lola Falana, and Melvin Van Peebles, and they're all at 3 in the morning at Paul Anka's suite, at the Palmer House, having early morning breakfast, all this fancy food. And at one point, you know, Anka didn't know anything about Kristofferson. Anka didn't know anything about Steve Goodman. And Kristofferson leans over to Goodman and says, can you get out your axe and play Would You Like to Learn to Dance?
I love that song. You know I love that song.
Yes. And so Goodman plays the song, and the first thing out of Paul Anka's mouth is, how would you like a plane ticket to New York? And, of course, this is a ticket to getting a record contract, getting introduced to people. You know, Anka was very well connected. And Goodman, I mean, he was always joking. The first thing out of Goodman's mouth was, well, you know, how would you like a plane ticket to New York? How would you like to see the short, fat Jewish kid dive into the vat of chicken Kiev? But after the joke, I mean, what would you do, Lise? I mean, if you were in that situation and Paul Anka is offering you a ticket to the big time, you have death on your shoulder. You don't know how long you're going to live. You're a musician. You've quit college to do this. Here's Paul Anka offering you
your dream.
Your dream. What would you say?
I'm sure I would have nothing eloquent to say.
You would probably say something like, thank you very much, sure. But the first thing that Goodman said is, well, if you think I'm good, you got to hear my friend John Prine.
So oh, that's
the next
right.
night,
he said that. Oh.
The next night, they go down to the Earl of Old Town Club late at night, 2 in the morning, where Prine has finished his show, and they sit, all this whole group sits there. They take the, you know, the chairs off the tables, and they have Prine playing to Kristofferson, Anka, and all these people all through all of his songs, and Kristofferson leans over to Anka and says, well, I guess you're buying 2 plane tickets to New York.
but that didn't really work out so well, right?
Well, it worked out great for the both of them.
Yeah.
They did come to New York, and coincidentally, at the bitter end, you're all familiar with that, coincidentally, that night, Kristofferson was playing at the bitter end. Prine and Goodman get into the airport, they open up the Village Voice, and they see that Kristofferson's playing there. So they say, we got to go down to the Village. And so they, during a break, they Kristofferson's outside going next door for a drink, and they run into him, and Kristofferson says, I got to get you guys on stage. Paul Colby, the bitter end manager, owner, says, I can't do that, Chris. I've got lines of people around the block. And Chris says, I want these 2 guys on stage. And so they get on stage, do 3 songs each. Prine gets a record contract that night. He gets an offer that night. But it takes about five more weeks for Goodman to actually get an offer. And this is kind of the great irony of Goodman and Prine. It's without Steve Goodman, we may not know about John Prine. And yet, John Prine, he always, I mean, he sold more records. Goodman and Prine toured a lot, and Prine was always the closer, Goodman the opener. It's just the ultimate act of generosity that Steve Goodman performed, and Prine is grateful to this day. You know, they were sort of musical brothers.
Yeah.
Throughout Goodman's lifetime, and Prine always, every show he does, he plays a song and dedicates it to Goodman, and the one that he usually plays is Souvenirs, which is a Prine song that's about friendship.
And how did you know I had that queued up, Clay Eales? I kid you not. It's ready to roll. So
this is a song that most people think Goodman and Prine wrote together, because the most definitive version of it is the one where they sing it together. And Prine says, well, you know, Prine says he's not much of a guitar player, and he says, Goodman makes it sound like I can play guitar on this. And then Goodman on this, he says that he calls himself the Zelig of folk music, because he tries to imitate Prine's voice, and it's kind of hard to determine who's Prine and who's Goodman when they trade off.
All right. Well, you know what? There's a setup I wouldn't have had the privilege of having without you on the phone, Clay Eales. And guys, if you want more information about Clay's book, Facing the Music, all about Steve Goodman, and it is an unbelievable, fantastic read. You can log on to his website, Clay Eales, CLAYEALS.com. And with that setup, here's Steve Goodman and John Prine and Souvenirs here on Anything Goes.
All the snow has turned to water. Christmas days have come and gone. Broken toys and faded colors are all that's left to linger on. I hate graveyards and old pawn shops, for they always bring me tears. I can't forgive the way they rob me of my childhood souvenirs. Memories that can't be bought, that can't be won at carnivals for free. Well, it took me years to get those souvenirs, and I don't know how they slipped away from me. Broken hearts and dirty windows make life difficult to see. But that's why last night and this morning always look the same to me. I hate reading old love letters, for they always bring me tears. I can't forgive the way they rob me of my sweetheart's souvenirs.
Memories that can't be bought, that can't be won, the carnival's for free. Well, it took me years to get those souvenirs, and I don't know how they slipped away from me.
Steve Goodman and John Prine, and the name of the song is Souvenirs. And you're tuned in to Anything Goes on member-supported WFDU-FM. I'm Lise Avery, speaking with Steve Goodman biographer Clay Eales. And you can get more information about this wonderful biography of Steve Goodman called Facing the Music by logging on to Clay's website, CLAYEALS.com, ClayEales.com. And, hey, Clay, you still there?
Yep.
All right, then. So now we're talking about Chris Christopherson and Paul Anka. Now, Chris produced Steve's first album, am I correct?
Yes, in a matter of speaking.
Okay, yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, Goodman, once he got his contract, Paul Anka was supposed to be taking care of him, but Paul had his own career, and he kind of felt adrift, Goodman did, and he was searching for a producer for this album. Nobody was really doing it for him. And then he crossed paths with Christopherson about a month and a half later, where he was on a billing with Christopherson. And he said, "Chris, do you know anybody who can do this?" And he said, "Well, you know, I could take you down to Nashville and do it." And because that's where Christopherson had his home base, so to speak, and really the producer of the album became Norbert Putnam, who was part of the what they call Area Code 615, this group of Nashville musicians and producers who would bring anybody in and back them up. But this is why Goodman's first album has so much of a Nashville country tinge to it rather than the true folky bass that Steve was. And there are several songs that Goodman wished he had a different production on, but hey, you know, it was for his first album, and he was just lucky to be there. At least that's the way he looked at it.
Right. Absolutely. I completely understand that. And he seems like he was that kind of guy in general, right? Just a guy who was an appreciator and never, even when he did have some success, didn't take himself particularly seriously.
Well, you know, one of my most favorite quotes in the book from Goodman, and there's a ton of them, is in the introduction, where even just a year before he died, knowing that he would never have a hit of his own performed by him, he looked back on his career and he said, "You know, I've been grievously overserved."
You know, I've got the Broken String song queued up, which we have to play for everybody so they get an idea of who this man was. Is there a story that goes along with this?
Well, Goodman played his guitar very hard, and you know, a guitarist's nightmare is when you break strings. It breaks the whole mood and momentum of the show, and you usually have to stop and restring, or if you have a spare guitar, you at least have to switch to it. Goodman developed this technique right about the time he started opening for Steve Martin, of instead of stopping his show to change a string when it would break, is that he would restring the guitar while improvising a song in the key and in the rhythm of the song that he was singing in the middle of. And this would go on for 10 or 15 verses, and he would sing about how he's got to restring the song, restring the guitar, and bring me a G, this was not a prepared kind of a thing, because he'd break strings in different songs. It didn't, you know, I have, you know, thank goodness for the people who put tape recorders at their feet during concerts and recorded them. I've got about 300 of those tapes.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
And
that's hysterical.
I've got about instances of 20 or more where in different songs he does this routine that I've never seen or in research never found anybody doing before him or afterward. It's really a tour de force where he takes you on a tightrope, because each couplet you think, oh, how did he rhyme that? And is he going to do it again? Is he going to fail? And meanwhile, he's restringing the guitar. It's like two different actions at the same time. And then, boom, he goes right back into the song and resumes it where the song left off. And you can imagine the ovation at the end of the song. And typical Goodman, you know, if you see video of this, there's one YouTube video out there of him doing this in the song Danger. And at the end, there's just the typical shrug at the end, like, no big deal, you know, don't make too big a deal of this, you know.
And it's testament to the brilliance of his brilliance as a lyricist. All right,
All right,
you guys, that, again, set up far better than I ever could in a million years from Mr. Clay Eales. Here's Steve Goodman after Breaking a String here on Anything Goes.
Well, I like songs about robins, right? There's, you know, been more than one good one. Open a set with one, so close a set with one, just to see. No. I broke a string. I have to stand up here and sing. I was wrong. The set's one too long. I broke a string, broke a string, broke a string. Now if somebody please, who works in his place, could go in the back and open the case and bring out a set. Oh, you bet. I changed the string, changed the string, changed the string. It won't take long. It won't take long. And then I won't have to sing this goddamn song. Goddamn song. Oh, no. If he'd only bring another string, another string, another string. Oh, please, bring it to me. If you can't find the whole set, then find the G. Find the G. Oh, no. I'm out like a bird with one wing. Without my string, without my string.
Steve Goodman. he improvised all those all the time.
Yes,
Clay.
I mean, and the proof that it's not something that he set up is that the lyrics were different each time. The rhythm was different. The chords were different. It's phenomenal. It's just truly phenomenal.
That's unbelievable. That's really unbelievable. Now, let me ask you a question, Clay, because I know you have places to go and people to see. We're coming up to the top of the hour here, and I'm going to have to let a message play at 11 o'clock. Can you stick around for a few more minutes on the other side?
Sure.
Okay, I just have... before we get there, I just wanted to ask you about Arlo Guthrie in the City of New Orleans. How did that happen?
Well, Guthrie was playing The Quiet Night in Chicago just a month or so from the time of the Christofferson story, and Richard Harding, the club owner there, pulled Goodman in. Goodman was there to watch Arlo's show, and Harding knew about Steve's song City of New Orleans, and he sort of locked Arlo and Steve late at night in his manager's office and said to Steve, play him the song, play him the train song. And Goodman was sheepish, and Guthrie, he tells the story in almost every concert. He says, you know, I don't want to hear songs. I hate songs. I hate my own songs. You know, and Arlo, that was my favorite interview of the whole book, 2.5 hours at a Mexican restaurant in Louisville. He says, you know, I probably made myself, in that story, make myself out to be more of a butthead than I really was. But the classic punchline of the story is, Arlo says, all right, you buy me a beer and play a song or do whatever you want, and as long as that beer lasts, you can go ahead. And then he says, and that was one of the finer beers of my life.
So you think that is a true story? I've heard Arlo tell that story.
Well, you know, Arlo's a great storyteller, and he's gotten to the point where it's decades ago, and, you know,
Who knows?
You know, it's the Liberty Valance thing. When the legend's better than the truth.
Arlo, I think, says in the book, or in your book, he must have said this to you, that he brought the song home and he left it on his piano for a really long time.
Like, that's right. That's right. And then he came back to it. And in the meantime, he had taught the song to John Denver out in California. And John Denver released a version before Arlo did.
Oh, I forgot that. Yes.
And he sort of eviscerated the song. He took out the last half of the third verse with the disappearing railroad blues and Good Morning America, I Love You. I mean, he kind of turned into City of New Orleans Light, and Arlo was furious about this, not just because Denver beat him to the punch. It was much less that than changing this classic song, and then on the album taking half the credit for it. If you look on that Denver album, it says by Steve Goodman and John Denver. And he finally read John Denver, The Riot Act, a couple years later.
Arlo did?
Yes.
Because Steve Goodman wouldn't have had the power to do that. Wow.
Well, you know, Goodman was furious about it, but Arlo was the one who sort of took it to John and said, look, you can't do this. This guy's sick. He's trying to build a legacy for his family. And Denver holds up his hands and says to Arlo, you know, Arlo, you're on. I'll make it right. Don't worry about it. And he did make it right. But in kind of a strange way, he's...
You're going to have to hold that story, Clay, because the board's about to go away with me. We'll be back with more with Clay Eames here on Anything Goes.